From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, America's export boom. 2 years ago, President Obama made what some called a quixotic pledge.
We will double our exports over the next 5 years, an increase that will support 2 million jobs in America.
Now, America is on target to hit that goal. Plus, a look at how a sour economy has made food stamps the new welfare. Also, you know those Kobe beef sliders on the menu at your local bar? Well, it's not what it's being sold as.
Real Kobe beef does not make for good burgers. You're never going to see a Kobe beef burger on a menu in Japan.
Also, more stories from round 8 of our 3-minute fiction contest. Plus, what's topping the Billboard Latin charts and why American movies and music follow the 40-year rule.
It's the period we look back at as somehow innocent, as a kind of Edenic moment before the fall.
That's all on this episode of the Best of Weekends on All Things Considered. In his State of the Union address 2 years ago, President Obama argued there were a few things the U.S. needed to do to begin recovering from the economic recession. Here was one of them.
We need to export more of our goods. Because the more products we make and sell to other countries, the more jobs we support right here in America. So tonight, we set a new goal. We will double our exports over the next 5 years, an increase that will support 2 million jobs in America.
Now, most economists at the time dismissed that pledge as somewhat quixotic. But 2 years on, the U.S. is actually on pace to meet that goal. American exports are up 34% since the president gave that speech, and that number is still climbing. Our cover story today, the American export boomlet, what we're selling and where it's going. And one of those export hubs happens to be New York City, where we sent producer Jeff Jones to visit a Manhattan skyscraper at the intersection of Fifth Avenue and 52nd Street.
Thank you. 30th floor, right?
To check out an office.
So how many people are at work here?
This office is probably, I'd say, 7,500 people.
And there he met Madison Riley, a managing director at the company, which is called Kurt Salmon.
Some of our colleagues right here.
And what sort of exports is this company producing? Well, actually, they're not producing anything.
I don't think that we think of ourselves necessarily as exports, although we certainly are.
Kurd Salmon is a consulting firm. They provide services, business advice, strategy, and increasingly they do it for clients outside the U.S.
You know, in the past 5 years, we've seen significant increases. We're very active in China, obviously, in Singapore, in Japan. We are active in Canada. We're active in Mexico. We're active in the U.K., Germany, and France.
Services, things like consulting or design or architecture, IT, they now account for about a quarter of all U.S. exports. But it turns out traditional exports, things we're making right here in the U.S., well, that side of the American export market is also doing pretty well.
That's a punch. That part that you heard it making just now is something that we're exporting to China.
That's Drew Greenblatt. He's the owner of Marlin Steel. It's a metalworking business in Baltimore that makes things like wire baskets.
Right now we're standing on the factory floor. We have 30 employees here, and we're making parts that are going to ship all across the world. We export to 36 countries. We're working around the clock, and we're growing.
Later, off the floor, I asked Drew Greenblatt exactly how much his business has grown, and the answer is it's almost doubled.
We did just shy of $5 million last year, and we're hoping to do $8 million this year. We're very bullish on the future.
Wow, $5 million last year, $8 million this year. That means that business has really picked up. Is some of that coming from exports?
A lot of it's coming from exports. Exports is critical to our hiring and our investment and our optimism in the future.
And it's not just advanced manufacturing. Pork, cattle, and all kinds of agricultural exports are up as well. Even craft beer.
This is the fermentation cellar. These are cylindrical conical tanks.
Jim Caruso is showing off the equipment at his Maryland brewery. He's the CEO of Flying Dog Ale. Maybe you've tried their beer before. Well, increasingly, he told us, people all over the world are doing the same.
Well, we ship to Amsterdam, and from there it goes to 19 countries. But the top countries for us are England,
Sweden, Italy, and the Netherlands.
Wow, you're getting the Low Countries. They're drinking your beer in the Low Countries. That's a big deal. I mean, these are some of the best beer-making countries in the world. England, Netherlands. Why do you think there has been an uptick over the last year or so in exports of your beer?
Well, I think a couple of different reasons. A lot of wine drinking over the last generation, and a lot of the people who have very sophisticated wine palates are now transferring that knowledge and that sensory experience to beer. There's microbreweries popping up across
the Okay, Europe. That's a pretty specific answer. How about this, though? Why, across the entire economy, why the upswing of more than 30% for exports and everything from management consulting to craft beer? I put that question to Tyler Cowen, an economist at George Mason University, who's written about the American export boom.
Well, some of it is we were starting from an artificially low base due to the financial crisis. So some of the numbers are a bit misleading. But the general trend really is there. A lot of it is being driven by smart machines. So the U.S. has high wage rates, which is a disadvantage. But if machines are doing a lot of the work, that doesn't matter.
Here's something that you wrote, which I thought was really interesting, counterintuitive, that as China's economy continues to grow, America will become a bigger winner. Explain that.
Well, Chinese wages have been going up because they've become more productive, and that's good for China. It's good for Chinese workers. But the big advantage that China has incredibly cheap labor, those days are somewhat in the past, so the United States and Mexico will become, in relative terms, more competitive. This will mean that we export more.
Export to who?
Literally to everyone. If you look around the world over the last 10, 15 years, with a few exceptions such as North Korea and parts of Africa, most economies have been growing quite robustly in the developing world. So those economies used to invest in construction, so they would buy timber, they would buy copper, they would buy building materials. But the wealthier they get, the more they will want to buy business services and aircraft and entertainment and pharmaceuticals, exactly the kind of things we're best at making.
The president, when he pledged to double exports in 5 years, he also set a goal of creating 2 million jobs, new jobs, with that increase in exports. A, has that started to happen? And B, can that happen?
Job growth has been a lot more sluggish than virtually all of us had predicted. Fossil fuels and natural gas will give us quite a bit of job growth, but a lot of our exports will not. Think of it in terms of technical skills. If you're great at working with computers so that they augment your productivity, you'll be a pretty big winner. But if you're competing against computers, you're likely not to do so well. Companies have become more productive by shedding workers and lowering costs. So I don't at the moment view exporting as a way of creating a very large number of jobs, but it will create a lot of output and profits.
Can the president take credit for the export boomlet, if you will, over the last few years?
Presidents have much less control over the economy than we like to think, both on the upside and the downside. So it's mostly driven by longer-term structural factors. And in terms of credit or blame, I tend to minimize the role of any president.
So right now, when you look at this export situation and this boomlet and our overall economy, you are pretty optimistic.
Well, I think we need to disaggregate the good news and the bad news. If you're an owner of capital, if you're a business, if you're someone with technical skills, if you're someone who works with smart machines, I'm extremely optimistic. If you're someone who is not that skilled and you're faced with dysfunctional education and healthcare systems, then I would say I'm fairly pessimistic. The end result, I think, will be a kind of polarization of economic outcomes in the United States, depending essentially on education. How good are your skills? How good is your self-discipline? How high is your conscientiousness?
You think we're already starting to see that trend now?
I think we've been seeing it for over a decade. If you think of computers as getting really powerful in the early 90s, we start seeing this to a very small degree already in the 90s, and it's picking up pace today.
Economist Tyler Cowen from George Mason University, he's written about the American export boom in the latest issue of The American Interest. Now, another part of the export picture has to do with the increasing ease of doing business globally. And not just for businesses selling products, but for businesses like Kurt Salmon, the management consulting firm we heard from earlier. Now, if you're thinking that selling consulting from Manhattan isn't the same thing as shipping a car overseas from Detroit, well, the nation's top trade official, Ron Kirk, would invite you to think again.
4 out of every 5 Americans now is employed in the service sector.
The future of U.S. exports, he says, is not just in things Americans make. It's in the ideas and services they provide.
Services are a critical component of our export and make up about a quarter of our exported goods. And that can include anything from architectural and engineering services. For example, Brazil is going to be privileged over the next 48 months to host both the World Cup and the Olympics. They've got to build everything from roads and bridges and streets and subways to a number of stadiums. In many cases, American architects and engineers will be involved in the design of those, but we may also be involved in the financing and insurance of those. The other significant part of that, as opposed to manufactured goods, in which we still tend to buy more and consume more than we make, we have a balance of about $180 billion in our services trade. So it's an important element of our export policy.
So when we're talking about services, it's things like legal services, consulting, IT. It seems straightforward when it comes to products, right? So John Deere tractors, let's say they send 500,000 overseas. We can measure that. How do you measure services in comparison to goods? How are you able to say, five consultants going overseas to help a company increases our exports this much?
Well, that's a very good question. I'll be honest, it's one we've struggling with. And it is much easier for hard goods and agriculture. But we also know that the numbers that we report for that very reason tend to be underreported. And when we dig into it and talk to the industries, we find that those numbers tend to be greatly inflated.
And up until 2003, the United States was the largest exporter in the world, surpassed by Germany that year and then a few years later by China. How important is it for the United States, in your view, to become the top exporter again? Is that a priority?
It is both a priority and an opportunity. And I say that, well, we are entering a period of time now where 95% of the world's consumers live somewhere other than the United States. And as the rest of the world has looked at our economy, our model, they're finally beginning to develop a middle class. And as these hundreds of millions of new consumers now come of age, we have the opportunity for us both to rebalance our trade and to have an economic model that's going to be more sustainable and create jobs that Americans are looking for.
That's U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk. He told us if you're a business owner interested in learning more about how to export your products, check out ustr.gov. Our cover story today, the newly poor and how food stamps have become the new welfare. And a big reason why is because of a deal struck between President Bill Clinton and the Republican-controlled Congress back in 1996.
Today we are ending welfare as we know it. But I hope this day will be remembered not for what it ended, but for what it began.
At that time, the number of Americans who received cash payments, what's often thought of as welfare, was at an all-time high. The Clinton overhaul made it much harder to qualify for those payments, and today, the welfare rolls are down 70%. But that's only if you define welfare in one way.
Well, we decided cash assistance is welfare, and that's bad, but we decided food aid is nutritional assistance, and that's good, and we made that program much, much easier to get on.
That's New York Times reporter Jason DeParle. He covers poverty, and he's talking about food stamps. Since the economic crisis that started in 2007, 18 million Americans have had to apply for food aid, and it's become a political target for some critics of the program, like Newt Gingrich.
No president has put more people on food stamps than Obama.
Now, that's not technically true. More people went on food stamps under President George W. Bush. But what is true, says Jason DeParle, is that more Americans depend on food assistance now than at any other time in modern history. Almost 50 million Americans, or one in six people.
The question is whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing. Some people would say, look, this is bad. Dependency is on the rise because people are on food stamps. I think there's also a strong case to be made in the opposite direction, that this is a safety net program that has responded to the worst economy since the Great Depression. If it wasn't for the food stamp program, there would have been much, much more hardship in the United States. Poverty would have risen twice as much. It's been a vital form of support for many people.
Okay, well, when you come in the front door, this is my living room slash bedroom.
This is Vicki Jones. She's giving a tour of her one-bedroom apartment just outside Chicago, where she lives with her 7-year-old son, Jack. Vicki is studying to become a chiropractor.
I'm in school from 8 to 4 almost every single day, and then I come home, I take care of my little boy, get him a healthy dinner, You know, he does homework, get him off to bed, and then I study.
A few weeks ago, she decided to write about her situation for the Chicago Sun-Times.
Long story short, my marriage fell apart. We ended up losing our house, and we ended up declaring bankruptcy and divorcing. And so now I'm a single mom, and I need to feed my son. I need to feed myself. I applied for food stamps a few years ago, and I truly believe that at some point I will be able to pay this back and to help people in my situation who can't afford good medical care.
It sounds like when you're talking about the decision to accept food stamps, you almost sound apologetic for it, almost like you have to justify it, and I wonder why.
I guess there's part of me that says this wasn't supposed to be my life. I did so well in high school. I went to college. So that was a hard pill to swallow, just having to step back and go, I need help. I can't do this myself.
How much does it get you every month?
It's $367 a month.
And is that enough to pay for your food?
It's really not much. When you break it down to a 30-day month, you know, that's $12 a day to feed two people, three meals a day. So it's not a lot of money, especially if you're trying to, you know, give your son healthy fruits and vegetables, and an avocado costs $1.50, and I've got approximately $2 a meal.
You wrote that you had hidden this from your family and your friends, and even when you went to the grocery store, you were careful about the way you used the cart. Why did you hide it from everybody?
I just felt like there was a stigma attached with being on food stamps, and the reason I wrote the article was because I saw a posting on Facebook comparing feeding wild animals to giving people food stamps. And it just kind of was like a sucker punch in the stomach. And it was from someone who had been a good friend of mine. And I thought, she has no idea that the person she's talking about and comparing to a wild animal is her friend. And I thought, I need to speak up for the other people out there like me who are just trying to make ends meet and trying to make a better life.
That's Vicki Jones. She lives just outside Chicago. Food stamps have now replaced cash assistance as the most common form of welfare in America today. 10 times more Americans receive food aid than those who get cash welfare. Now, back in the mid-1990s, Ron Haskins was an aide to congressional Republicans, and he was one of the architects of welfare reform. And he argues that back then, the government faced a huge problem.
Welfare dependency. There were just too many people that became dependent on welfare. For example, a very good study at Harvard showed that 65% of the people on the rolls at any given moment would eventually be on the rolls for 8 years or more. And that's the kind of thing that Republicans were concerned about, that people were literally learning to depend on welfare and not learning to support themselves. So that was the overall goal of the bill. And that is why probably the most important actual change in the statute was ending the entitlement. Under previous law, people that met the qualifications for welfare had a legal right to get the cash benefit, and Republicans said, no, that's wrong. They should not have a legal right. They have to do something in return, namely, they have to work.
So it made it much more difficult to get that cash payment, and the result was that the welfare rolls for the cash payment system declined dramatically. Would you characterize it as a success?
Yes, I would characterize it as a success. The group that's most likely to go on welfare are never married mothers. For never married mothers, between roughly the mid-90s, 95 or so, around the time of welfare reform, and 2000, the percentage of never married mothers who worked increased by 40%, completely unheard of. And since employment increased so dramatically and poverty fell like a rock for female-headed families, which is the group that was involved in welfare reform, yes, welfare reform was definitely successful. There were problems, but it was a great success.
Looking at it from our perspective now, in the middle of this economy, as you know, critics of that welfare reform have said, well, it was great in good economic times, but now it's different, and it's actually causing major problems. Would you agree with that?
I would partly agree with that, yes. The employment rate for single moms, and especially for never married moms, is actually still higher than it was before welfare reform. But they have trouble finding jobs. The ratio of job openings to job seekers is as bad as it's ever been. Our unemployment rate is still above 8%. It's a big problem. And We just did not want to go back to a system where people would be on welfare year after year after year and not have to worry about anything. They have to still be conscious about work and actively look for work. That's the kind of system we need, and that has not worked well during a downturn.
That's Ron Haskins. He helped Republicans craft welfare reform back in 1996. When President Clinton signed off on it, one of his top officials, Peter Edelman, resigned in protest. He warned that it would leave the most vulnerable Americans, people living far below the poverty level, even worse off.
And it turns out the real proof of what a really bad public policy this is in the recession.
How so?
Because when people went for help during the recession, they could get food stamps, and it turned out they could not get welfare. It's as simple as that. So food stamp participation went up from a little over 30 million before the recession up to 46 million people now. Now, again, these benefits are not huge, and I'm just amazed at the demagoguery that goes on. It pays the food stamps, if you have no other income, it pays about a third of the poverty line. And in fact, we have 6 million people in the country, shockingly, whose only income is from food stamps because welfare is basically gone. And because there's no legal right to welfare, there were about 3.9 million people on welfare, shrunk from the 14 million of the mid-90s when the recession started. It only went up in the recession with all the need that was out there to about 4.5 million. So that tiny increase versus the food stamp, the food stamps, you have a right to get it. Welfare, you don't.
Tell me about how the states have played a role in diminishing the number of people who can receive cash payments. Because my understanding is the states get a block grant from the federal government, and in many cases they can decide what they want to do with that money. They don't have to spend all of it on welfare payments.
That is certainly true. And so the message that came with it back in 1996 was to get people off welfare in any way. If they got a job, that's fine. But if they didn't, that was okay, too. And every state could set its own rules, including not serving anybody they didn't want to serve. 19 states have less than 20% of their poor children getting cash assistance on welfare. And as a consequence, we have this huge increase in the number of deeply poor people.
So how do you explain the argument that some have made that poverty has actually decreased in America since that time?
Poverty has not decreased. They're making that up. There are 46 million people who are poor right now. And some of that is from the recession, but starting in the year 2000, the poverty numbers went up steadily almost every year. And then another big jump starting in 2007 and 2008.
What would you do now? I mean, if you were advising President Obama.
Number one, we have to hold the line on these programs. Congressman Paul Ryan is proposing a budget that is reverse Robin Hood. Robin Hood would turn over in his grave. That's going to add over $5 trillion over 10 years to the wealthiest people in this country who most surely don't need it, more tax cuts, and take about the same amount of money away from the lowest income people. It's astonishing. So if we understand that food stamps is an enormous policy success, that the earned income tax credit is very, very important, that people need those things because of the way in which the economy works generally, on top of the fact that for real people, the recession is still there.
Peter Edelman teaches law at Georgetown University. His forthcoming book is called So Rich, So Poor: Why It's Hard to End Poverty in America. Could Use Atlanta raise Kobe beef? It's a menu item that increasingly is popping up all over the country, and I have a couple of menus in front of me here in the studio from local restaurants in Washington, D.C. Here are a few choice items. We've got a ground Kobe beef and sirloin burger with smoked mozzarella. That is $10. Here's one from another menu. This is a Kobe beef burger topped with Tillamook and aged white cheddar, $16. Here we go. This is for Kobe steak ravioli with spinach and chestnut pasta, $34. Food writer Larry Olmsted has noticed Kobe beef's growing popularity, but on his Forbes magazine blog recently, he revealed this. If you have ordered Kobe beef in a restaurant in the United States, you were lied to. You did not eat real Kobe beef. So what did you eat?
It's really impossible to say, except you can guarantee that it was not real Kobe beef. Particularly if you get a slider or a burger, you know you're in trouble, because real Kobe beef does not make for good burgers. You're never going to see a Kobe beef burger on a menu in Japan. It's too fatty and too marble. So the only way to make it into a good burger is to mix it with a bunch of American cows and, you know, make it more like American beef.
Okay, so what is Kobe beef? I mean, if it's not what I'm seeing on the menus in restaurants in the U.S., what is it?
Well, it's a particular breed of cow under Japanese law, the Tajima breed, that has to have been born in Hyogo Prefecture, which Kobe is the capital of, raised there, fed a certain diet produced there. They're not, contrary to what a lot of people think, grass-fed beef. They eat some local grasses. They also eat hay and feed. And they have to be slaughtered in Hyogo Prefecture, where none of the slaughterhouses are approved by the USDA for export. So even when Japanese beef wasn't banned as it is now outright, Kobe beef wasn't coming here.
Okay, so I don't get it. How is it possible that this world-renowned beef that is so expensive, you say only 3,000 head of cattle, Kobe cattle, exist in the world. How is it possible that restaurants all over the United States advertise Kobe beef, Kobe beef burgers? I've seen Kobe beef hot dogs. How is that possible?
Well, it's the Kobe beef growers or cattlemen in Japan have both patents and trademarks on the different terminology, Kobe beef, Kobe cattle, none of which are protected under U.S. law. So we can call pretty much anything we want Kobe. You know, really, as the Department of Agriculture cares that when you call something beef, it's beef, and that's about it.
Now, as a food writer, I'm assuming you've eaten Kobe beef.
In Japan.
In Japan, okay. So is Kobe beef, real Kobe beef, better than like a USDA prime ribeye that you can get at, you know, one of these great steakhouses in America?
I personally don't think so, but that's very much a matter of taste. You know, it's like saying, is red wine better than white wine? Its thing is that it's buttery, right? It's really fatty, but it's so marbled. And, you know, most steaks we get, there's meat and there's fat. There's not that much marbling, but the fat is so spread throughout it that there's a little bit of fat in every bite. And as a result, it sort of melts on your tongue. It's very rich. It's very buttery. Yeah, it's a matter of taste. It is very good.
That's Larry Olmsted. He's a blogger for Forbes.com. He writes about travel and food. Larry, thanks.
Thank you.
She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. That's the starting sentence for round 8 of 3-Minute Fiction. That's our contest where we ask you to write an original short story that can be read in about 3 minutes. Our readers from across the country are combing through all of our 6,000 submissions this round. Let's hear a sample of their favorites so far.
Rid yourself of this pest today, she'd read in the ad in her chicken book. Well, she'd thought, reading it last night after she'd heard the noises. Well, she'd thought, reading it again this morning in the only chair in the house that didn't wobble, the soft chair in the front room that got the morning sun. Well, she told herself again, I'd best be getting to it. She swung the shotgun to a comfortable carrying angle and headed toward the barn. She knew Ed would be in the barn, finishing the morning chores, because it often took Ed until mid-afternoon to finish the morning chores. Sure enough, when she dodged the big puddle that never dried and entered the barn by the far door, there he was, leaning with arms crossed over the rail of the pig pen, smoking and scratching his favorite pig, Cleet, with a tobacco stake. Ed, she said. He didn't hear her. She cleared her throat and tried again. Ed! She said, louder this time. He looked up and saw the shotgun. Essie? His face was as broad and as blank as a frying pan. What is it? Rid yourself of this pest today, she thought, and took a deep breath.
That's NPR's Bob Mondello reading an excerpt from the story Rid Yourself of This Pest Today by Elizabeth Bitsy Hawes Unangst from California, Maryland. That is a real place. Here's another excerpt our readers picked.
The man shrugged and the woman left. It was strange in the sunny kitchen without her. He listened to the refrigerator hum, the clock tick. He considered turning on the radio, but it was Sunday. His programs wouldn't be on. He wondered which church she had gone to. They had been married by the Methodists because she liked the way the classic white church at the head of the lake looked in autumn. The bridesmaids wore turquoise. They had not been to services there since. They had not had the baby baptized. Perhaps his wife had mentioned it at the time, but he did not want the infant subjected to a ritual he didn't understand, just so the ants could gather for deviled eggs and miniature sandwiches afterward. His wife took his daughter to Easter services at the Catholic chapel on the corner one year. They went late at night and watched the baptisms of the converts. His daughter was enthralled, talking about incense and the choir all the next day. He worried that perhaps this was something she would want to do regularly, but by the following weekend, she wanted to go to the shore with her friends. She had not come back from that trip.
That's the voice of NPR's Susan Stamberg reading the story Just in Case by Robin McCarthy of Belfast, Maine. You can find both of these stories and more at our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction, and that's 3-minute fiction all spelled out, no spaces. Be sure to tune in next week when we check back in with our judge, Luis Alberto Urrea. Time now for music.
Nossa, nossa, assim você me mata. Ai, se eu te pego, ai, ai, se eu te pego, ai, delícia.
This song by Brazilian superstar Michel Teló is burning up the Billboard Latin charts right now. And normally the list is a guide to the most popular Spanish language music in the American market, but right now this song, as you might have guessed, it's not Spanish at all. Judy Cantor Navas is the managing editor of Billboard en Español. She's with me now to talk Michel Teló and other top tracks on the Billboard Latin charts. Judy, welcome.
Thank you, Guy. It's great to be here.
This song, it's called Ai Se Eu Te Pego. I think I got that right, right? Something like that?
Yep, sounds like you got it. Now you just need to learn the dance that goes
okay.
with it.
So the English translation is, Oh, If I Catch You. It's the number one song on the Billboard Hot Latin Songs charts right now. It is not in Spanish.
And it is actually the first time we have a Portuguese song that hits number one on this chart.
And how did it become such a huge hit?
Well, really, it was all because of soccer. What happened was that some of Brazil's best-known soccer players, starting with Neymar, the star of the Santos team, and a Real Madrid player, Cristiano Ronaldo, and some other players, they just started to dance to the song at games after scoring a goal. It became like the goal celebration song. And then they started posting videos of the players dancing to the song on the field and also in the locker room. And these videos have been seen millions of times on YouTube by now. And actually, the video of Teló performing the song has been watched almost 300 million times.
Wow.
I mean, it also helps that it has kind of this frisky little dance that goes with it. If you remember La Macarena,
the whole thing.
So it's kind of like that, and it's an easy dance to do. So it's just really spread around the world.
That's the Brazilian singer Michel Teló with the current number one hit on the Billboard Latin charts. You've brought us another artist that you've been listening to a lot and been writing about, and his name is Prince Royce. The song is called Las Cosas Pequeñas, or The Little Things. Let's take a listen to it first.
Tu sonrisa, tu carita, tu forma de ser, presión no tiene, y es amor, yo lo sé, nada vale más que un beso fiel.
So, Judy, this has like a real R&B vibe to it. And the guy that sings it, Prince Royce, he's actually American. He was born in the U.S.
Yes, he is American. His parents are from the Dominican Republic. He's 22 years old. He's doing a style of music that's become known as urban bachata. It's really mixing R&B with bachata, which is this tropical syncopated rhythm. And I think it appeals to all generations.
And that's the thing about him that I've read, that he appeals to a lot of first or second generation Spanish speakers in America because he is bilingual, he's American.
Yeah, well, he really appeals to young Latinos because he's just like them. You know, he's got R&B, he's got kind of a hip-hop style, and then he grew up in his house listening to bachata and boleros, so he's got it all, and it's not like a forced attempt at crossover.
That's the new track from Prince Royce. It's called Las Cosas Pequeñas. Let's move on to the last track that you brought for us. Who are we listening to right now?
This is Tribal Monterrey. And if you see it written, it looks like Tribal MTY. What they're referring to is a kind of music called Tribal. It's like tribal music. It's an electronic music, and it's mixed up with cumbia and other Mexican rhythms. They call their particular brand of this tribal guarachero. And it's, you know, it's loud, it's kind of very fast, hectic.
And this has been on the charts, the Latin charts, for 28 weeks. Mm-hmm. It was number one in March. It's now at number three, but that's amazing.
What was more surprising to me was that it's really found a regional Mexican music audience as well. And that is surprising because you think it's more for an electronic music, a dance crowd, than the kind of people who are going to usually be listening to corridos or to more acoustic regional Mexican genres.
So this is appealing to like an older audience and a younger one as well?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's doing a bit what Prince Royce is doing. It's really crossing generations, and it's also crossing more into the mainstream. And, you know, both of these artists are experimenting with different rhythms and genres. They're mixing up the old and the new. So they're changing music that we're listening to in the United States, and they're really changing the definition of what Latin music is at the same time.
That's the band Tribal Monterrey. They'll be at the Billboard Latin Music Conference in Miami next week. All three of the artists we've just heard from will be performing at the Billboard Latin Music Awards this Thursday, April 26th. Judy Cantor Navas is the managing editor of Billboard en Español. Judy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and we're going to talk about music, movies, and culture now, and in particular, about something known as the 40-year rule. Adam Gopnik is with us now from New York. He's written about it for the latest issue of The New Yorker. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Guy. How are you?
I'm good. Let's explain this with a pop quiz, Adam. You know the answer, so don't give it away. This is for the listeners.
All right.
Everyone out there who's listening, take a guess at which of the following songs won the Grammy for the best rock and roll recording in 1966. Here we go.
Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 because I've made your reservations.
Okay, it was the Monkees with Last Train to Clarksville. That was the nominee. Here's another option.
Look at all the lovely people. Helena Rigby.
Okay, we all know that one, the Beatles, Eleanor Rigby. And here's the other option for 1966 Grammy for Best Rock and Roll Song. I love that song, Adam.
First record I ever bought.
Unbelievable. The Beach Boys, of course. So we got the Beach Boys, the Beatles, the Monkees. All of these were nominees in 1966 for Best Rock and Roll Recording. Adam Gopnik, you have the answer. Who won the Grammy for Best Rock and Roll Recording in 1966?
Winning record, and we could throw Painted Black in there and a few others,
oh, yeah,
was Winchester Cathedral. Winchester Cathedral by the New Vaudeville Band.
Winchester
there it is.
Cathedral, you're bringing me down.
they weren't even a band, really. You know, they were one of those studio inventions that had to be thrown together to do that number.
How is that possible? I mean, Eleanor Rigby, Good Vibrations. How does Winchester Cathedral win the Grammy for Best Rock and Roll Song in the 60s?
This is the golden demonstration of the 40-year rule at work. It's the middle 60s, right? The most revolutionary decade. And yet, there's this lingering residual nostalgia for something that had happened 40 years before, for this music of the mid-20s. It's the period we look back at as somehow innocent, as a kind of Edenic moment before the fall. That almost always seems to be 40 years back.
Why is it 40 years?
Well, I have a theory about that.
Okay.
And my theory is, it's not so much that pop culture is made by 40-somethings. In fact, it's usually made by young folks, like the Beatles, made by 20-somethings. But it's usually produced in every sense. The suits who organize it, decide what goes on, are usually 40-somethings. They're people between the age of 40 and 50. And we are fascinated, I say as one of them, we are fascinated by that moment just before you were born. It's kind of this, in every imaginable sense, the sexiest moment in the history of the universe is the moment just as your parents were making you.
Adam, you write about this in the latest issue of The New Yorker. You're looking at all these sort of cultural signposts throughout the last, 20, 30 years. Let's talk about one of them that a lot of us are focused on now, Mad Men, right? This huge cultural phenomenon, not just a TV show, but like Banana Republic ads.
Exactly.
This is a show that takes place 40 years ago.
It's interesting, too, that Matt Weiner, who's the creator and the maker of it, was born exactly in 1965. So he is just in that kind of space, that sweet spot, where it's not just that we're interested in the early 60s, it's that we load it with the feeling that then life had a kind of freshness that it doesn't have anymore. They were able to smoke innocently.
Don't you love the chase? It's like having that first cigarette. Head gets all dizzy, your heart pounds, knees go weak. Remember that?
Because they didn't know it would kill them. They were able to drink innocently at 3 in the afternoon.
I bet daily friendship with that bottle attracts more people to advertising than any salary you could dream of.
Don't you think that's part of what draws people to watching Mad Men? They say, oh my God, it's 11 in the morning, and they're going to drink. They're having rye and whiskey and scotch, and they're going to light up a cigarette. And we know it's wrong, and yet we wish we could.
And there's been a lot of talk about the Titanic this year. Of course, it's the 100th anniversary. You trace the nostalgia a lot further back.
How many people are there on board? 2,200 or more. One room in the boats for...
Adam, do you recognize that?
How many?
I do indeed. A Night to Remember.
1,200.
This is the epic drama of the greatest disaster in the history of the sea.
The first of the great films about the Titanic, which comes to us right on time in the mid-50s.
40 years after
the original. And again, you know, it's partly because, though that's a terrific movie, it's also because that's the kind of space of time you need in order for something to, in a certain sense, be drained of its terror. It becomes spectacle.
No writer of thrillers could ever achieve such agonizing suspense.
You mentioned the 60s, of course, but back to the Beatles for a moment. You say each of the last four Beatles records, which all came out in at the end of the 60s, each of them contained or included a song that harkened back to the sound of the 20s, right?
That's right.
Okay,
for Let It Be,
that's an exception. We'll forget about the exceptions.
Right.
Let's hear one of those songs, When I'm 64.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will he still be sending?
And now that sounds a little more like Winchester Cathedral.
It does. It's in the same spirit. In fact, Paul McCartney sped up his vocal to make it sound a little more 20s-ish, a little more megaphony. Like everything the Beatles touched, it's magic, it's melody, it's wonderful of its kind. But it's also a genuine looking back, as in the entire Sgt. Pepper record is in a way. But it's, again, the 40-year thing. And the funny part about it is I talked about how producers in the broad sense help create this effect. The Beatles' special producer, the great George Martin, was born in 1926, so right exactly on time. And I genuinely think one of the things that's going on in those wonderful Beatle retrospective numbers is that Paul McCartney and George Martin are playing a kind of game. You know, can you write the music of my childhood the way I'm producing the music of your youth?
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 60?
In the 80s, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Empire of the Sun, Hope and Glory, all set in the...
In the 40s. Hope and Glory is a nice example. Wonderful film, but it's all about an innocent view of World War II, the one subject in which you'd think it would not be possible to have an innocent view. But John Borman, the director, draws exactly from his own childhood memories of being a kid in the Blitz and thinking that it was kind of cool, that it was something wonderful about the transformation of the world then.
You write about the 90s, particularly that Gap ad. I remember that Gap ad, the Brian Setzer Orchestra.
Yes.
With the song Jump, Jive, and Wail.
Looks like it's gonna help.
And you had, like, all of these kids in khakis dancing around, jumping around.
Come inside, let me teach you how to jive and wail.
Tagline said, khakis swing.
Khakis swing, or Kerouac wore khakis, so that Jack Kerouac, 40 years later, which at the time seemed to be a document of American disaffection, suddenly became a document of American delight. We're always looking for a period that we can imagine as being somehow simpler than our own. But at a deeper level, you know what I think? It's that our kids right now, sitting in their strollers and in their cribs, they're seeing details that we're so used to that we don't even notice them. You know, we drink our lattes every morning at 10 a.m., and we're no longer aware that there's something weird about that, any more than the advertising men in 1962 were aware that there was something weird about drinking whiskey at 11 in the morning. And our kids will be storing that stuff up. And 40 years from now, they'll make art out of it, and we'll finally see what our lives were really like.
It's Adam Gopnik. He writes about the 40-year rule in the latest issue of The New Yorker. Adam, thanks.
Pleasure.
By the way, Adam, one last question for you.
Sure.
Well, whatever happened to Winchester Cathedral?
Winchester Cathedral sort of rose and fell. It was one of those great one-off songs of the 60s, you know, like Question Mark and the Mysterians and so on. And they disappeared. The one-hit wonders, but this one, 40 years old.
Winchester Cathedral, you're bringing me down. You stood and you watched out. My baby left town.
For the week ending April 22nd, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, the show was directed by Lauren Silverman and edited by Mathoni Maturi. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, and Becky Sullivan. Lauren Beneshew is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.
You're bringing me down. You stood and you